Hi, I'm Kev Jackson. Thank you for joining me today on Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors. Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors is sponsored by DS Beverages, Paul Bunyan Country's distributor of Anheuser-Busch Beverages, and by Bond and Lock and Key, Paul Bunyan Country's home for Liberty Safes, as well as Northern Surplus in downtown Bemidji. Today, one of our regulars joined us, but it is not a regular show. We are in a very strange time, and we're all processing things differently. There's a lot of fear, a lot of nervousness, a lot of anxiety. So we needed to hear this story today. Dick Beardsley joins us. And yes, we will talk outdoors a little bit. But the reason I brought Dick in today, for those of you who don't know, he has an amazing story. A story of hope in dark times. I would have loved to have Dick in the studio. Obviously, right now, that's not possible. We did this via cell phone. It's not always perfect audio, but stay with it. You need to hear this. Thanks for joining us. Well, today on Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors, we need to hear something positive, so we are turning to one of the most positive people I know, Dick Beardsley. Dick, thanks for taking the time today. We really appreciate you taking some time out to do this.
Hey, thank you, Kev. It's always nice being with you. I always enjoy it.
Well, Dick, let's start with the outdoors. There probably isn't any place than outdoor fishing and hunting and maybe a walk in the woods that is good natural social distancing.
Boy, that isn't that the truth, Kev? You know, this is the time of year now, too. You know, we've had some, you know, long days now. The snow is melting, and, boy, everybody has got some cabin fever, wants to get out there and enjoy the great outdoors. And definitely, we're so fortunate to live in the Bemidji area here. And we've got such, you know, beautiful scenery to look at. And we've got, you know, great areas to go out and hike and fish and whatever you want to do. And it's a great way to get out. And as long as you're doing your social distancing, you know, the fresh air has got to be good for you, I would think. It sure feels good to me anyhow.
No doubt. Have you been fishing lately?
Well, I've been out on the ice, actually. There's, you know, now up until last Friday, I was driving my 3/4-ton pickup truck all over the place. But now I'm not driving out anymore, but we're actually, you know, walking out. And the problem is getting to be now is, in some areas, some lakes, that shoreline is starting to pull out a little bit, and the accesses are really, you know, pretty much done for the most part, just because of all the traffic over the last part of the winter here. But there's still, you know, good ice. There's plenty of ice out on the main lake, but the problem is trying to get out to it and whatnot. But on most lakes, you can still access them, and my way of travel now is kind of like it was when we had all the snow and slush is to be walking out, pulling your gear and whatnot. But again, any time of the year, but especially early in the season. And now as we get, you know, into the spring season out there on that ice, you always got to be careful and know where you're going. And you know, safety's got to come first. That's for sure.
All right. Have you seen any open water areas out there yet?
You know, I was actually, before we got this you know, stay at home kind of a thing from the governor, I was out in Chamberlain, South Dakota. I had a guide client out there from the cities that I take out quite a bit around here. And we went out to the Missouri River at Chamberlain for some open water walleye fishing. And we did really good. It was, Kevin, let me tell you, it was so much fun having a 7-foot rod in my hand instead of a foot and a half long rod in my hand. One day we were out there, I think it was Sunday, it was just gorgeous. You know, there was no wind, it was about 62 degrees, and the fish were biting, and that was a lot of fun. But on my way back home, I kind of came back the scenic route through southwestern Minnesota, and then up kind of, you know, northeast up towards Bemidji. And when I got to just south of Willmar, Minnesota, the lakes, once you got just south of Willmar, then all the way north, the lakes were still froze up. But from there south, the lakes were all wide open. So I'm sure there's some people, you know, down around that Fairmont area where they've got a bunch of lakes, and maybe in that Mankato area, that people are probably out there doing a little panfish now, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would assume that that can happen now. So
yeah, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take long. And of course, there's been a a lot of folks fishing the Mississippi River in pool number 4 down there near Red Wing for walleyes and sauger. And unfortunately, nobody's going to be fishing the Rainy River this spring, of course, because of all the accesses being closed. But that's not such a bad thing, I guess. You know, we got plenty of time for open water, and even though it's catch and release on the Rainy, it'll be nice letting those walleyes just kind of do their spawning without anybody thunking them with a jig on the nose.
Hey, I would think one of the issues we're going to find once we get to open water season is, you know, with the stay-home orders and things of that nature, the guys who get the boat accesses ready probably won't have a lot of them ready by the fishing opener. We may need to know people on the water to get our boat out there.
No, you're right, Kev. And if they do, you know, a lot depends on what happens now in the next 6 weeks or so. But if this coronavirus pandemic continues to, hopefully not, but if, let's say, it would continue to get worse, there may be a decision that, you know, the public accesses, like on the Rainy, are going to be closed for a bit, and the only way you can get out there, you'll still be able to fish, you just won't be able to launch your boat unless you know somebody that has a private access at their cabin or home or something like that. So hopefully it won't come to that. But I guess only time will tell what happens between now and the fishing opener on May 9th.
You know, we really do need to get out and do the kinds of things we like to do. And again, the fishing and hunting thing is in, you know, something that naturally does give you that separation by and large.
Right. It's
a weird time, Dick. It's a strange time. I think we're all worried. I know you know you've got a bed and breakfast, a hospitality business, and as a fishing guide, a hospitality business, and there's a lot of question marks.
Oh, Kev, there really is. And, you know, excuse me, my wife Jill's kind of the worrier of the family, you know, I kind of look at things like, well, you know, it's going to work out. It just might, you know, take a while, but it has put us into a difficult situation. You're right, you know, with no income coming in, and, you know, I haven't had any cancellations on my guide business of guide trips that are already booked, but I'm not, usually by about now, you start getting the end of March into April, the phone and the emails start coming in, and people want to, you know, book a day or two of open water fishing. And as of right now, those are pretty much not coming in. And I can understand people, you know, they don't want to make arrangements and not have them happen. So it's a tough situation for, you know, for fishing guides, for people that own resorts, hotels, motels, bed and breakfast, anything to do, you know, the restaurants, at least they're able to do the curbside and carry out, things like that. But boy, it's put a strain on everybody, and we're worried about it, you know, not just, you know, obviously for economic-wise, but, you know, just for people's health in general, and you just never know, you know, who's going to get this and how it's going to affect them, and you start hearing about some younger people that have gotten it and have gotten real sick, and some even have, you know, passed on, and it's a scary situation we're in, and we just got to, you know, keep our distance from people. And I know we went into our bank to chat with our folks at the bank today, and, you know, I'm one that likes to give people a good handshake, and, you know, if I know I'm halfway decent, I usually give them a little bit of a hug, and it just felt weird, you know, just, hey, good morning, you know, and it's just different time that we're going through right now, but the one thing is that it's affecting everybody. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, you know, how much money you make, what you do. Everybody's affected by it. We just kind of got to do our best and keep our chins up and try to get through this the best we can.
Dick, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on, and we talked about this yesterday, is I've heard your story twice. Some people haven't heard it at all. And I just felt the story you have told over the years, I think, is something a lot of people need to hear right now. A lot of people don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. A lot of people are really, really scared. And I wanted you to show your situation, to show that, you know, you don't live in a fantasy world. You're living the real life thing too. But you have a perspective a lot of people don't have through some of the turmoil and troubles you've been through in your life. And I appreciate, first of all, you being willing to share it with our audience today. Thank you for that before we go forward.
Oh, you're very welcome, Kev. I'm glad I can do that. I really am, and I appreciate to share whatever you'd like me to share. And we all go through difficult times in our lives, and it's a lot of times we're able to look back and we make it through something like that, and it enables us to make it through another tough situations in our life. So yeah, thank you for letting me share.
Well, first of all, Dick, let's go back to the beginning. I find that interesting. As you grew up, you were into fishing and hunting, and then eventually found running, and really had quite a successful running career. Let's just pick it up when you're young and take us through that portion of your life.
Yeah, you bet, Kev. Yeah, growing up, my dad started taking me fishing when I was about two, maybe even a little bit younger, to be honest with you. And he was an avid outdoorsman, especially for fishing. And I fell in love with the sport, and I just absolutely loved it. I remember my dad always telling me, when I got older, he says, he always called me D. He goes, D, when you were a kid, we'd go out fishing, and, you'd get a little tired, and we'd throw a cushion up in the front of the old aluminum boat, and you'd take a little nap, and then you'd be right back up fishing again. He said, you never complained. No matter what the weather was, no matter if we were catching fish or not. And, my dad would always thank me for that. It seems like every time we went fishing, as I got to be an adult, and he lived quite a ways away at the time. But I just really fell in love with the sport. I spent a lot of time here in the Bemidji area as a kid. A good friend of my dad's was Bernie Backman, and Bernie was a wonderful human being on top of, a wonderful fishing and hunting guide. And I spent a lot of time with Bernie, like during Christmas vacation and other times of the year. I would stay right at Bernie and his wife Rosalind's house and their kids, and I'd go out with Bernie and his trap lines and go fishing with them. And in the open water season, I fished with Bernie and my dad a lot, and he was a mentor for me. And he's been gone now for quite some time, but In fact, I'm looking at a picture of him. I got of him up on a wall holding a stringer of walleyes right now. But so he really showed me the ropes about being a fishing guide. And I started doing that when I was about, 12, 13 years old. And I'm 64 now, and I still love doing it. But in between that time, I was big into hunting and trapping and things like that, anything to do with the outdoors. But at about 17 years old, I was in high school. I was a junior in high school, and girls kind of started catching my eye a little bit, more than like a dead raccoon laying alongside the road. I was such a shy, believe it or not, I was just a shy, bashful kid, and I couldn't even say hi to a girl, let alone actually ask one out on a date. But I noticed a lot of my buddies that were good in, sports would be wearing their high school letter jackets around, and they always had girls hanging all over them. So, my first thought was, golly, all I got to do is earn myself a letter jacket. And I went out for the football team. And for those folks who don't know my build, I'm about 6 foot tall, weighing about 135 pounds. And that first day of football practice, I got squashed like a pop can. And I remember getting up out of that pile of guys that hog tackled me. My helmet was on crooked. My shoulder pads were sticking out. My football pants were down to my ankles. And I'm thinking, there's not a girl alive that is worth going through this. And I quit. I quit. I actually walked off the field. Kept my entire football career from start to finish lasted about 43 and a half minutes. And at that time, I was devastated. I really was. My self-esteem, wasn't very high at that point. But I've said this to myself and to a lot of other people, a lot of times what we perceive as incredible disappointments in our lives can sometimes turn out to be great blessings. And that's what it was for me. A few days later, I went out for the cross country running team, and I'll never forget our coach, saying, okay, boys, we're going to do the around the block run today. Now, Kev, I've never been at all, a little bit in gym class playing dodgeball or something like that, but never gone out just for a run. But I'm thinking, well, surely I'm stubborn enough and I'm committed enough and determined enough that I can, you know, run around the block and stay with my teammates. And so anyhow, listen, to make a long story short, what they called their around-the-block run was actually 3.2 miles long. Now, that doesn't seem very far to me today, but back then it seemed like forever. And believe it or not, I had to walk the last mile. And in fact, by the time I got back to my high school, all my teammates and my coach had already showered and gone home. And when I crossed that imaginary finish line into our high school parking lot, I was so excited. I remember thinking, gosh, Dick, I don't know how far you just ran and walked, but you made it. And you know, I just thought to myself, if you work real hard and do what your coach tells you to do and believe in yourself and have faith, you know, I'll just bet you, Dick, you can get good enough to make the varsity squad, to earn the letter jacket, to get the date with the girl. That was my whole inspiration for running at the time, to get the date with a girl. And I did everything my coach told me to do, Kev. I, you know, showed up on time for practice and never complained about the workouts, even ran on the weekends. But, you know, I was terrible, and so I was relegated to the JV team. But, of course, you don't earn a letter jacket on the JV squad. And so when the season ended, I didn't run another step. And then that summer, when I got done with my junior year of high school, I'd set a goal for myself way before that, was to run every single day that summer. And I didn't miss a day. I didn't run real far or very fast, but I ran every single day. And I came back for my senior year, and we did that same around-the-block run. And this time, though, instead of all my teammates finishing in front of me, they all finished behind me. Now, that's not saying a whole lot, because we didn't have a very good team, but it really showed me that if you're willing to do the work and really have a purpose and a determination, no matter what it is you do, don't let anybody, especially yourself, ever keep you from pursuing those goals. And now, saying all that, I did earn my letter jacket. I did get a date with a girl then. You know, however, that's about as far as it went.
I am honored to have Dick Beardsley share his story today on Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors. We'll pick it up in his college years next. Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors is sponsored by DS Beverages, by Bonded Lock and Key, and Northern Surplus Northern Outdoors. Dick Beardsley, my guest today. I have heard this story a number of times. It always moves me. And it seemed like this was a good time to share this with anybody who has not heard it. We pick it up with Dick headed to college.
You know, I still wasn't a very good runner. And I never qualified for the state meet here in Minnesota in cross country. And then I did run track also my senior year. But, you know, the seed had been planted, and I'd fallen in love with this wonderful sport of running. And, you know, a lot of people, Kev, they think that, you know, when they look at my running resume or see some videos of some of the big races I've run in way back in my younger days, that a lot of people think, oh, man, I probably got a full-ride scholarship, you know, University of Minnesota, went on to the Olympics and so forth. Well, there was no scholarship, and I did go to the University of Minnesota, just not the one that most people think of. I went to the University of Minnesota at Waseca, in Waseca, Minnesota, which is now a federal prison, so it kind of tells you how far I got my degree from. But you know, Ken, I tell you, I had a coach there, Coach John Folkrod, and I still keep in touch with Coach, and he's been retired now for a long time. He's in his upper 70s, I believe, close to 80 now. But you know, especially this time that we're facing right now, all of us, you know, it's the things we say to each other, you never know how it's going to affect a person at that moment or tomorrow or next week or months down the, or years down the road. But one day, Coach Folkrod, after practice, he put his arm around my shoulders, and we're walking back into the gym, and he goes, you know, Dick, I really believe you can become as good of a runner as you want to be. And I never, ever forgot that. But honestly, Kev, you know, never in my wildest dreams when I graduated from high school in May of 1975 did I ever think that my running would take off and go like it did. So I was very, very blessed, that's for sure.
How did it evolve into that next level?
Well, so, you know, I went to the University of Minnesota Waseca, and then I was fortunate to really start improving in college. And I think one of the reasons was, first, I had a few more years underneath my belt of basically continuous running. But in college, you know, I could run up to 10,000 meters, so 6.2 miles. And it seemed like the further I ran, the better I was. And so then, because I improved quite a bit, I got a partial scholarship to run for out at South Dakota State University out in Brookings, South Dakota. And I ran out there in the fall of 1978. And our team, we were runner-up national champions in cross-country in the NCAA Division II. And then from there, when I got out of college, I continued to run and started using some things I'd learned from, you know, my high school coach and my college coaches. And then I picked up a book from a guy named Ron Dawes. Ron was a Minnesota guy, and he made the 1968 Olympic team. And I read his book. I felt like he was a lot like me. He didn't have a lot of talent, but he worked really, really hard at it. And I read his book, and he had lots of his workouts in there. So I started putting together some of his workouts, and my running just, it started to improve. And then I got hooked up with the New Balance Shoe Company. I took a time there at about the age of 21, 22, I wanted to see how good of a runner I could become. So I kind of put everything on the back burner. I was still guiding a little bit, but really I was putting all my effort into training. And I moved to the cities and rented a little one-bedroom apartment, and I was training at least twice a day, sometimes three times a day. But it was difficult just coming up with rent every month. And I remember, you know, I can still recall looking under the cushions in the couch for extra nickels, dimes, and quarters to put a extra loaf of bread in the pantry or an extra gallon of milk into the fridge. And my one pair of running shoes that I owned, honest to gosh, Kev, I had them taped up with some kind of like a duct tape just to hold them together because they were so worn out. But I didn't have a dime to buy any shoes. So, you know, long story short, I snuck into a big trade show that we're having for shoe companies like, you know, New Balance, Adidas, Nike, places like that. And I got kicked out three times before I finally snuck my way in there. And finally, I got hooked up. Everybody, you know, when I handed them my little one-page resume that was triple spaced, so it was still a whole page about my running, a little minor accomplishments I had. Everybody pretty much at these different shoe companies kind of laughed at me, but except one, and that was the New Balance Shoe Company. And I left the expo that day with a free pair of New Balance shoes under my arm, and it was unbelievable. And just that somebody else believing in what I was trying to do, my running went to another level almost immediately. And then eventually I got, you know, I signed a deal with the New Balance Shoe Company. And now this past November, you know, I've been with the New Balance Shoe Company for 40 years now. And believe me, it's not because of my running anymore. I'm slower than molasses in January. And like I tell people, Kev, I'm kind of like the Walmart greeter for New Balance. You know, they'll send me out to a running specialty store somewhere around the country, and I'll do a little meet and greet, maybe sign some posters and go out for a fun run with people. But so that really enabled me to continue to run. And then I got hooked up with Coach Bill Squires, who coached people like Bill Rogers, the four-time winner of the Boston Marathon, Alberto Salazar, you know, the world record holder at one time in the marathon, and many other top runners. And Coach Squires took me under his wing. He was in Boston. I was back home here in Minnesota. And he'd send me my workouts once a week in the back of a beer-stained napkin from the Elliott Lounge where all the runners in Boston hung out. And he took me to a level, Kev, that I never, ever thought I could attain. And, you know, I was fortunate to, you know, I was won the first London Marathon 40 years ago, and I won it with another guy named Inge Simonsen. We tied, actually, and he was from Oslo, Norway, and that was 40 years ago, and we've become great friends. And the neat thing about that is my grandma came over to the United States from Norway, and so I got a lot of Norwegian in me. And I was fortunate to win my first grandma's marathon in 1981. I came within, I think, about 9 seconds of the American record at the time and ran 209 there. And it just kind of took off. And then, of course, the race that, if you're a runner at all, that most people remember the most is a race I didn't even win. It was the 1982 Boston Marathon, where Salazar, who was at that time was the world record holder, and on a real hot day, him and I mean, we duked it out right to the very end, and he ended up beating me, you know, by 1.6 seconds. He ran 208.51, and I ran 208.52.6. So, I've been very fortunate, Kev. My running took me places that I'd only dreamed about or read about in magazines, and you know, I got to go travel around the world to compete. And unfortunately, about 9 months before the Olympics in 1984, which were held in Los Angeles, you know, I blew up my left Achilles tendon, and the Olympic orthopedic surgeon for the U.S. rebuilt it. But then I didn't have the time to really let it heal like I should have, and I was back training way too soon, and I was running a race out in California, and I snapped it again, and then it was, you know, 2 years of no running at all. But anyhow, I've been very fortunate, you know, that when I started running, I wasn't very good, but I fell in love with it, and I had a passion for it, and I still have a passion for it. And I still run every day, although, you know, I don't train anymore. I just go and run. For me, it's that hour at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm out there all by myself, and definitely social distancing at that time of the day.
Yeah.
But, Kev, it's my hour where it's just me. I don't have anybody, you know, pulling me this direction or that direction. And that hour I have with just me and the good Lord is, I get choked up thinking about it. So I'm really fortunate I can still get out there and still put one foot in front of the other, no matter how slow.
Well, Dick, it was an incredible stretch of time for you, certainly. After your active running career, you had some tough times.
I did. You know, I finally got back after 2 years of no running in the mid-80s to where I could get back and run again, and I qualified for the 1988 Olympic Marathon Trials and ran those out in New Jersey, just outside of New York City. I didn't have a very good race that day in 1988, but when I got done, you know, I had a smile on my face and knew that I'd given running my best. Now, at the time, I had just turned 32, and for me, it was time to move on and put that real competitive running behind me. You know, nowadays, that's just, you're kind of just, you know, not even reaching your peak yet. But back then, that was kind of considered getting kind of old. So, you know, we moved back. I had a dairy farm, and I was, you know, milking cows. I was doing my fishing guide business, and life was, I mean, I was living the life I always wanted to live. And then on November 13th, though, of 1989, I got in a really bad farming accident. I got in a little bit of a hurry, and I got caught in a power takeoff. And for people that don't know what that is, it's a long steel shaft, round shaft that hooks to the back of the tractor, and then the other end hooks to another piece of farm equipment. And when you turn it on, it rotates, spins at about 600 revolutions a minute. Well, I turned that thing on, and I turned to go do something. And when I turned, honest to gosh, Kev, I thought somebody had come up from behind me, grabbed me by my shoulder blades, and body slammed me into the ground. And anyhow, next thing I know, my left leg was being wrapped around that spinning shaft like a piece of string wrapping around your finger, and then started taking my whole body around, and I could feel myself, you know, as it would smack my head into the frozen ground each time it would whip me around, losing consciousness, and it was from the grace of God that somehow I was able to, I don't remember it completely, but I don't know if I hit the lever or was able to grab it enough to get it to where it got turned off. But it got turned off, but I was in rough shape, and I had all kinds of head contusions. I'd broken all the ribs on my right side, punctured my right lung, broke my right arm, had a piece of steel driven into the upper part of my chest, which I don't know where that came from, and then my left leg was almost torn off. But I had great doctors and nurses and surgeons and physical therapists and nutritionists and a will to want to get better, and the good Lord, they're helping me along, and I survived it and even got back to running again and doing my guide business and even still milking cows for a little bit. And then life was pretty much back to normal for the next, 2.5 years or so. And then in the summer of 1992, that was a farm accident was in November of 1989. The summer of 1992, then I got in a bad, really bad car accident. A lady ran a stop sign on a country road and T-boned my car and totaled out my car and I busted up my back and I was in the hospital for, a few more weeks and had major spinal surgery. But I recovered from that and got back to kind of normalcy again. And then it was probably that following winter, I was running down a street in Fargo, North Dakota. I shouldn't have been. It was almost like a blizzard out. And for a block, I had to get off the sidewalk because it was so full of snow. So I jumped out onto a one-way street with running with the traffic, which is a no-no. And anyhow, long story short there, I got hit from behind by a truck, and they found me laying in a snowbank. And so I was back in the hospital, more surgeries. But again, I was fortunate. I survived and got back to normal. And then the following spring, I was hiking at Lake Bemidji State Park there. And that was before any of the trails were really, nice like they are now. And I was down at the bottom of the lake going up that real steep, it's almost like a real steep bank going up. And it had been raining for a few days, and I got to almost the top, and I took one more step to the side of this small little narrow trail, and this big chunk of ground broke away, and I ended up falling literally like off a cliff and landing down on the shores of Lake Bemidji. I was in the hospital here in Bemidji for, 10 days or so again, and anyhow, so I've had more surgeries and been put back together and got a couple knee replacements, and I've got rods and screws in my back. Things happen in life, and honest to gosh, I remember people telling me they would say, my gosh, Beardsley, if you didn't have bad luck, you wouldn't have any luck at all. And I honestly, Kev, I never, ever looked at it like that. I really didn't. I'm one of these people that believe things happen for a reason, and there was a reason why these things happen, and there was a reason why I was still alive. But through it all, I was on a lot of narcotic pain medication for a long time, and I ended up becoming addicted to the narcotic painkillers, and it made these other things seem like a walk in the park. And it got to the point where the addiction, led to where I was doctor shopping. Now, this is back, this is back in the early 90s, and, there were the prescriptions and stuff weren't computerized. The doctor would just give you a piece of paper with his signature. So I'd go, when one doctor would quit giving me the painkillers, I'd go to another doctor and another doctor. And then when I couldn't find any more doctors, I started doing something I can't even imagine thinking about doing, let alone actually do. And I started forging, my own prescriptions. And I had never been in any trouble in my life and never You know, I'd never stolen as a kid even a piece of bubble gum, and here I'm doing something that, you know, I knew I could go to prison. I knew I could lose everything I'd ever worked for in my life, but all that mattered at that point was to get the pills, to take the pills, and make sure I didn't get caught. And by the summer of 1996, I was taking upwards of 80, you know, narcotic painkillers a day. And the fact that I didn't die is an absolute miracle. But thankfully, on September 30th of 1996, I got caught. And it was such a relief. But I knew I was in a lot of trouble. But I was so blessed and I was so thankful that I was still alive. And I knew the only chance I had, if there was any chance at all to get better, was to be 100% truthful and take responsibility for my actions. And that's what I did. And you know, I was interviewed by two federal drug enforcement agents that day I got caught, because I was writing so many prescriptions, they thought I was, you know, dealing the drugs. And when they told me that, I was blubbering so hard, I could hardly breathe. I told them, I said, you know, not one pill that I give, sell to anybody. I was too selfish. If I got them, I took them. And luckily, I was given 5 years of probation and 460 hours of community service. And I got right into a treatment program, first in the hospital. And they put me on methadone. And I got addicted to the methadone. And methadone is a nasty drug. It's a narcotic. And it's what they put heroin addicts on to keep them off the heroin. And to get off of the methadone, it's difficult. And finally, I couldn't get off of it. The withdrawals were so bad. And finally, they sent me down to the University of Minnesota Hospital. And I remember laying in my bed the first night I got there, and I was in such pain from the withdrawals. My bones in my arms and legs ached so bad that I honestly believe if I would have had access to a saw, I honestly think I would have sawed off my own arms and legs. It would have had to feel better. And in the mornings, it was just to get my legs on the outside of the bed and put on a clean pair of pants. It seemed like it took me forever. But, you know, I never missed a meeting with my group to try to learn how to get better. And there were some mornings, Kev, I was so sick from the withdrawals, I had to crawl on my hands and my knees like a dog down the hallway to get to my group meeting. And I'll never forget one morning, I'm actually crawling like a dog down the hallway trying to get down to my group meeting because I was so sick I couldn't stand up to walk down. And I blacked out, and when I came to, I remember laying in my own vomit. And I remember looking up and saying, God, please, God, either just take me right now, or please, God, help get me better. And that night, I actually slept for the first time in over a week for just a little bit. And then the next day, I slept a little bit more and a little bit more. And after I'd been there for about 3 weeks, I started to feel what it was like to be me, Dick Beardsley, without those drugs in my body. And I liked how it made me feel. And the last, little over 23 years I've had of sobriety from those narcotic painkillers have been the best, you know, some of the best 23 plus years I've ever had. And, you know, Trump, I got to tell you, so to go back a little bit, so after that Boston Marathon in 1982, 38 years ago, I remember after I recovered from that and got back to, you know, feeling myself again, because that race beat me up so bad, I'm thinking, well, the good thing about being beat up like I was in that race is I know I'll never have to go through anything more difficult in my life again. And, you know, I was 25, 26 years old at the time, and I really believed that. Well, then when I, you know, had the farming accident and all those other accidents and all the surgeries, well, once I recovered from all of that, I remember thinking, well, the good thing about all that is, at least I know for sure now I'm never, ever, ever going to have to go through anything more difficult. And I really believe that. but then again, I was wrong. And after I had, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years of sobriety from the painkillers, I remember one day thinking, boy, I would never, ever want to go through this or put my family through that addiction of mine that I had. But the one good thing that has really come from this is I know absolutely, unequivocally, I will never, ever go through anything more difficult. And I firmly believed it. I would have bet my life on it. But I was wrong again. My son Andy, we adopted Andy when he was a little baby from Honduras. And he was my little fishing buddy, and we did lots of things together, and he was just our pride and joy. And when he turned 21, he joined the United States Army, and it was such an honor for him to serve our country. And I'd never been so proud of anybody in my life, because Andy kind of lost a little direction when he got out of high school, but when he got into the Army, it did something to him in a very positive way, and I was so proud of him, and he really was. It was an honor for him to serve our country. And then, like a lot of soldiers back then, and he got deployed to Iraq, and he was a gunner on Black Hawk helicopters, and then when he wasn't doing that, he was in charge of a crew that when the choppers would come in from the field with the wounded soldiers, they would get those wounded soldiers off. They do a quick mechanical check and a refuel of the choppers and get them back up in the air. So he saw a lot of things, had to do a lot of things that weren't real pleasant. But after about a year and a half in Iraq, he got home. But he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. And 4 years ago, this past October, just outside of Detroit Lakes where Andy grew up, my son Andy took his life. And I was absolutely devastated. And when I was told, I had just gotten back from a guide trip, and when I walked in the house, there was a police officer there and a social worker, and they told me what had happened. And I literally fell off my chair, and I thought I was having the worst nightmare I've ever had, but obviously it wasn't a nightmare. And I look back on that, and I miss my little boy every waking moment, you know. And he was 31 at the time, but no matter how old he was always my little boy. But, you know, one thing that brings me hope, and believe it or not, brings me joy and leaves me with peace, is knowing that all those bad nightmares and the darkness and all that that really got to Andy, that that's all gone. And knowing that someday I'll be able to put my arms around, and someday I'll... Sorry. Someday I'll be able to put my arms around Andy again and give him a big hug. Leaves me with peace. So, you know, and in this time that we're going through now here in Minnesota, across our country, across the world, with this pandemic that's going on and this coronavirus, I know it's difficult on people. It's difficult on my wife, Jill, and I, but I know that it will get better, and you got to believe that it will get better, and hopefully people will stick to the guidelines and the rules that they're having to try to, you know, do, and hopefully this will be behind us, you know, sooner than later, and we can all get back on with our lives, and hopefully none of us will get real sick and lose any loved ones or people we know, you know, hopefully something good can come from this. And usually, if you look hard enough, at least for me, sometimes you got to squint your eyes to see light at that end of the tunnel, but hopefully we'll be able to look back and take a little bit of good from this. And I'm already seeing it a little bit, you know, even though, you know, many of us are pent up in our own little home environments, or we're able to go out and walk, but what it's done is it's brought in families a lot closer together, you know, because now we got to spend all of our time with the people we love, and we get to do things together again, and a lot of people have that time to do it, and I think once we get over all of this that's happening right now, I think that'll be the glue that binds families together in a way that maybe without this pandemic, it never could have. So hopefully something good will come from this, and we'll all be able to get on with our lives, and we'll be back to normalcy sooner than later.
Dick, I've heard this story a few times now, and I've been brought to tears a few times now, and I'm really honored, and I thank you for doing this, because we needed to hear this today. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, Kevin. And, you know, I just want to leave the listeners with this, and thank you for letting me share. You know, a lot of people don't like to talk about bad things in their lives, but for me, I can't imagine keeping it all pent up. And if something I say helps somebody else, maybe through a difficult situation, then I'm glad I'm able to, you know, partake, and I sure appreciate your time and effort to let me do this. But in leaving, I'd like to leave the listeners with one last thing that I try to do every single day, and it's always helped me through difficult times in my life, and the four things I try to do every day, anybody can do them, and they're quite simple. And these four things are this: when I wake in the morning, I try to wake up with a smile on my face, enthusiasm in my voice, joy in my heart, and faith in my soul. And those four things have gotten me through a lot of difficult times, and hopefully they'll get our listeners through those too. So again, Kev, thank you so much. I can't, you know, you and this radio station do so much for our community, and thank you so very, very much for what you all do. I really appreciate it.
The man I am very proud to say is my friend, Dick Beardsley, joining me today on Paul Bunyan Country Outdoors. And Dick, again, thank you, and I look forward to talking fishing and other outdoor activities with you hopefully real soon.
Hey, thanks, Kev. Have a great day.